Thursday night, cloud and nothing more than the odd spot of rain will spread south across England and Wales. But for northern England, Scotland and Northern Ireland under clear skies, it'll be a colder night and there'll be a patchy ground frost. Friday will be fine, dry, until another band of rain reaches northwest Scotland by evening. That's the forecast. Here again is Luke Tuddenham.
Nick, thank you. Now, on Radio 4, our Book of the Week, Colin McFarlane reads another extract from Thomas Brothers' new account of Louis Armstrong's early years in Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism.
Shortly after Lillian and Louis got married in February 1924, King Oliver and his band were approached with a proposal for a big tour, following the established vaudeville circuit from Pennsylvania to Michigan. Out on the road, Oliver started to loosen his hold on his protege. "He decided to let me do everything and anything that I choose," wrote Armstrong, feeling perhaps that Armstrong was less of a threat on tour, or perhaps needing more help to carry the show. Oliver let him sing and do a little comedy dance, in which he pretended to fall and hurt himself. He took some solos, too, to help the old man out, he said. And the customers really went for it in a big way. Oliver got in the habit of disappearing for a stretch during the middle of a performance. Word of Armstrong's appeal got around, with some managers insisting, to Oliver's great irritation, that Armstrong's featured participation be advertised in advance. The tour made it clear that Louis was no longer a second cornetist. Lillian made a direct appeal to her man. Oliver was holding him back. And I said, "I don't want to be married to a second trumpet player." I told him he had to get out of Oliver's band. Finally, he agreed. They expected Oliver to be furious, but he merely shrugged and said he'd been lucky that Louis stayed with him this long. Those 2 years of playing with Oliver's band had been crucial in shaping his rapidly maturing talent, and he always acknowledged his debt. "Sitting by Oliver every night, I could pick up a lot of those little tactics he made," he said. Those included the most important aspects of his style, blues phrasing, vibrato, an ability to invent a musical phrase, and various ways of creating rhythmic drive. It was a deep transmission of one man's vision to a worthy disciple, the kind of relationship all teachers hope for. Still a bit shy, Armstrong had trouble figuring out what to do next. Lil suggested he talk to Ollie Powers, a singer at the Dreamland Cafe, a big man with a lovely tenor voice. He gave Armstrong a place immediately. It was a small band with only one cornetist, so there were solo opportunities. And that's when Louis started playing and showing what he had in himself. Now was his chance to shine. Word of his ability reached Fletcher Henderson in New York City. He offered him a whopping $55 a week to come and join his orchestra at the Roseland Ballroom on Broadway. Armstrong accepted, making a break with Chicago and putting the Oliver years behind. Interestingly, Lillian stayed in Chicago. She went with him on his initial trip, then went back home, saying her mother needed help. But there was more to it. The down-home hustler from New Orleans and the high-powered university chick still had their imposing differences. As long as Lillian was dedicated to holding a ladder for her husband to climb, they were working in synchrony, but that can also be difficult to manage. She told him how to dress, how to eat properly, how to manage money, how to notate music, when to leave Oliver, and what to do next. Musicians teased him about being henpecked, but Armstrong dismissed it as jealousy. "They was broke all the time, and I always had a pocket full of money," he chortled. Arriving in New York, Armstrong found his way to the rehearsal room in Harlem and introduced himself to the leader, who greeted the nervous 23-year-old with a gruff, "Your part's up there." He was on third cornet. Henderson called for a medley of Irish waltzes. The arrangement included markings for playing loud and soft. By this time, Armstrong had some experience reading music, but he'd never seen fortissimo or pianissimo before. When the band came to a very soft passage signaled by the standard abbreviation PP, everyone quieted down, except him. Henderson scolded him, and Armstrong quipped, "I guess I thought PP meant pound plenty."
It was a miserable day. He was painfully aware everyone was checking him out or ignoring him. "I'm sitting there saying to myself," he remembered, "what am I doing with this bunch of old stuck-up folks?"
His long underwear showed below his trouser hem, and he carried a cardboard suitcase. The drummer teased him about his clunky shoes. Things would improve, but he never really settled in completely. He couldn't stand the social pretensions. Later in life, he would write bluntly,
"Fletcher got so carried away with that society shit and all his education. The fellas in his band had such big heads."
In the end, he negotiated all of this, just as he negotiated class tension in his own marriage, and he moved up another step in his career. But New York was never easy. It was less friendly than Chicago, with fewer black-owned businesses.
"More high-class and cold-blooded," he said.
The dancing was different, too. Less sensuous and, with the partners, not as close together. A friend of his observed that the city was a machine town, like everything is in a hurry. Very cold black people and very cold white people, too. Henderson's band played in the whites-only Roseland Ballroom, described by Variety as the class dance place on Broadway. Like most large ballrooms, the Roseland hired two orchestras every night, alternating on separate bandstands to provide continuous music for dancing. Less typical was the Roseland's format of having a white orchestra go head-to-head with a black one. And in spite of the fact that Roseland was for a whites-only clientele, the job helped Henderson attract attention in the black community through radio broadcasts and recordings, but also simply because it put him in a class with elite white orchestras. With Henderson, Armstrong played opposite the best white society bands of the day. The leap from Oliver to Henderson could not have been more dramatic. The key to King Oliver's ascent in Chicago was his cultivation of the bluesy African-American vernacular. The key to Henderson's in New York was his ability to mimic the white orchestras. One thing was obvious. Their audiences each got the kind of music they were looking for. What was less obvious was that what each audience wanted was shaped by attitudes about race. During this period, it became attractive to think of jazz as something that naturally belonged to the white bourgeoisie. And the more jazz belonged to whites, the less it had to do with blacks. It was argued, for example, that musical improvisation was practiced in Europe all the way back to the Middle Ages, so perhaps the African-American antecedents had no importance at all. Henderson worked hard to eliminate any vulgarities and crudities in his band, to show they could be just as bourgeois as whites. So we can see why he was a little concerned when he found out on day one just how vulgar and crude his new hot soloist was. What was Armstrong's opinion? As a professional musician running for top dollar, he was willing to put up with
a lot of society shit,
as he called it, and he never flinched from that willingness for the rest of his life. One thing we do know is that Armstrong was ambivalent about the word jazz anyway, as were many of his colleagues from New Orleans. The intensely racist attitudes that shaped so much thinking around this may be part of the reason why musicians from Armstrong to Ellington to Gillespie and beyond always tried to avoid labels for their music as a general principle. Henderson hired Armstrong as a hot soloist, which meant playing brief solos 15 to 30 seconds long, at designated spots in the arrangement, providing a bit of variety. Many years later, Armstrong bristled at the limitations.
"He'd give me 16 bars, the most, to get off with."
It's easy to project on these performances a sense that he's bursting out of this tight control. But at the time, he seems to have accepted the assignment fully and made the best of his brief moment in the spotlight. The fascinating thing about the meeting of Henderson and Armstrong was that, although they were on very different trajectories, they shared a drive to enter white markets. During his time in New York, the young cornetist achieved more precision, more control over his instrument,
He also impressed with his sound, his big imposing authoritative sound, produced with a bursting initial attack, a full, rounded tone, and lots of volume. It was a sound born on the streets of New Orleans. Brassy, broad, and aggressively dramatic, as one critic said. Henderson recognized the opportunity that was open to him, to differentiate himself from his competitors. Enforced segregation took away with one hand, and sometimes it gave back with the other. Armstrong's distinctive command of the black vernacular was something white musicians simply couldn't match. And the advantage for Louis himself was that he could make increasingly bold experiments within the confines of his role as hot soloist, which would form the foundation for his innovative musical modernity. There were also a few occasions for him to sing. Thursdays were vaudeville night at the Roseland. When there was a shortage of entries one week, his colleagues encouraged Louis to sing, and he offered "Everybody Loves My Baby" and won first prize.
Oh, brother, oh, baby, now. Now you're coming to it.
The regular crowd started calling for him to sing each week, but his appearances didn't extend beyond these contests. While he was in New York, he seemed to have had a girlfriend in Harlem, a dancer known as Fanny. This information comes from a sketchy source, but it's hard to believe, given his romantic history, that he simply gave up female companionship while Lillian was back in Chicago for long stretches. Certainly, he was not waiting patiently. "No one to talk with. Just me and my radio," as he would sing in Ain't Misbehavin' a few years later. January 14, 1925, was another momentous day in music history. In Columbia's recording studios, Armstrong joined the Empress of the Blues, Bessie Smith. They recorded 5 tunes, then another 4 in May. This legendary pairing is part of the magic of Armstrong's year in New York. He said he didn't get to know her very well and never saw her outside the studio. He knew her well enough to ask for change for a $100 bill, though, and was astonished when she cheerfully lifted her dress and pulled a fistful of bills out of an apron around her waist.
"Like a carpenter carries his nails. Louis, I'll give you change for $1,000, she laughed.
The two shared a distaste for people who put on airs. Her niece said once,
"Bessie never forgot where she came from, and she hated to see black people get all fancy and try to act white. She had no use for that."
Those words apply perfectly to Armstrong as well. Soon afterwards, Armstrong attended a farewell party in his honor at Small's Paradise in 135th Street. Years later, he remembered this as one of the few times in his life when he got thoroughly drunk. The festive moment was spoiled when, sitting next to his leader, he vomited all over Henderson's neatly pressed tuxedo. The dignified Henderson turned to a friend and mumbled, "Take him on home." It was an inglorious end to an eventful year. And next morning, he was on a train, hungover, and headed back to Chicago.
Colin McFarlane was reading from Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism by Thomas Brothers. The book is abridged by Eileen Horn, produced by Clive Brill, and is a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. And now on Radio 4, time for the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on...